Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast, as well as the founder of the Rise Above Justice Movement. Today, I am joined by Brooke. Brooke is a licensed marriage and family therapist, mother, reverend, psychic medium, now turned doula after escaping and surviving domestic violence. As you know, October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And Brooke is going to be a part of that series, highlighting the survivor voices, highlighting the experiences of survivors and overcoming triumph and turning it into passion to help others. Her lived experience from childhood trauma, working in various human services fields, medical neglect and trauma, single motherhood while navigating the daunting legal system, and her terrifying divorce uses the lessons and wisdom from these stories to provide compassionate guidance to others overcoming abuse, isolation, and trauma that all of us as women face. Brooke offers a variety of services, coaching, skill building, trainings, and intuitive guidance. Brooke, welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on here.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's jump right in. And you're a trauma doula, liberator, you're a guide, reclaiming the voice of those that was taken from them. Walk us through what it means to be a trauma doula, guiding women, mothers, survivors to truth, safety, and liberation.
It's being a trauma doula is like a self-coined term. I can't really find anyone else on the internet with that title. What inspired it is during, I would say, my whole entire life, there was a lot of childhood trauma and abuse that I had a very conflictual relationship with my mom that I've done a lot of healing work around. But during this last 2 years of my life, I really just felt like I wanted and needed a mom to guide me in the traditional systems, like mental health therapist, everyone around me obviously cannot be that for me. And so I have shifted my work as a licensed therapist to now this trauma doula role, which is more of, I guess, calling it more of that, a trauma doula instead of a coach, because I want to help guide survivors with just that, like, nurturing and motherly, like, guidance and protection. And not just in domestic violence. I know that I think we're all impacted by domestic violence in some degree, but I think relational violence, systemic violence, and neglect is so paramount and huge that we don't talk about. So just want to be that person that can give that, mother bear energy role, but also like that soft and compassionate side.
Absolutely, which, oftentimes a lot of survivors absolutely need. Sometimes they just need somebody that understands, and sometimes they just need that listening ear to help guide them to get to onto their own healing journey as well. And honestly, it sounds great, right? But we know oftentimes in a lot of communities, access to those resources do not exist. And I admire your work that you do, and I love the title of trauma doula because it goes deeper into what it means being a doula, but also helping others gain that, gain the just gain their voice back that was taken from them because of trauma. And I admire the work that you do. And I want to jump right in and you became a doula after escaping and surviving domestic violence. Can you walk us through your journey?
Yeah, absolutely. This, I guess, shift in my career has been very, very recent within the last couple of months. I back in my mind through the last year and a half, where I officially escaped and got an order of protection on my ex-husband, last early February, February 9th, 2024. Right after about a week and a half, I asked for a divorce after finding out about a ton of infidelity and just seeing, how clearly one-sided the relationship was, and I was exhausted, but I had no idea how he was going to escalate. I had a couple therapists mention he was abusive per our sessions. I was in a lot of denial about it because it really it only got physical a couple of times, but the psychological and mental, emotional, financial abuse was tremendous, and now I can see that. But as a therapist myself, there was a ton of, I guess it was survival mode for the first year, having almost full custody of my daughter, going through the divorce process. You know, I just kept living life as normal, like Therapist Brooke. I didn't talk and tell a lot of people my story, partially because of, I think, shame, but a lot of it I hadn't really fully reflected on and processed yet. But I just knew through my like healing and just self-work after being able to escape kind of this therapist role is always going to be a part of me. But being so passionate about sharing my story online and connecting with so many other survivors, the ethics and limitations around being a therapist just weren't fitting in the way that I wanted to support others and survivors, since I understand the ethics here of like being a therapist, why there's clearly appropriate boundaries and all of this stuff, but realizing the mental health system is also created under all of the other systems, like the justice system, that are built on patriarchal structures that are often very oppressive. Because my whole life, not just within being a therapist, I've always been told I'm too sensitive, I care too much about others, I self-sacrifice a lot. And those qualities in me have always been, I think, like seen negatively. And I've worked to be appropriate with those boundaries, but you know, I really just want to be that person that I want to be able to meet people where they're at as a human and not have that kind of power dynamic where I, you know, me being a therapist and being the expert in the room and I have to be perfect and have my shit together, it just couldn't work for me anymore. I'm shedding all of these layers of the unhealed versions and like the traumatized versions of me have been liberating, but I had to step into a different role and be more creative to be able to, you know, meet people where they're at their homes if they need to be picked up and taken for in order of protection. I've done that before. Ethically, therapists, that's a big no-no. if they need to just, you know, text me off hours because they feel threatened by their abuser and they have no one else to talk to, I want to be able to be that person. You know, I want to also be really upfront and blunt and real with people and be more of a kind of like a hands-on coaching role as well, which therapists aren't supposed to be doing that. So I, yeah, created this new, I guess, yeah, business of mine, being a trauma doula, to kind of be that guidance and also blend in some spiritual tools and knowledge, intuition building as well, to help survivors really reclaim all parts of their lives.
Incredible that, turning your own rage, your own pain into helping others overcome that is very admirable. So, first of all and foremost, thank you for doing that work. It's a very thankless job because it's kind of like being a nurse. You're there during people's deepest and darkest and roughest times. And oftentimes, again, those supports lack in a lot of communities. And overcoming those barriers and understanding the necessity for providing these services is something that you did. And again, thank you for doing that.
No, thank you so much. I appreciate the kind words. I've honestly gotten some negative feedback from those, unfortunately, in the mental health community. I think a lot of judgment because it is such a new concept. I really, there's not anything out there, but just wanted to create something that I needed.
Absolutely. And I look at the history of therapy and look at the history of the mental health system. And again, like you stated, the mental health system is far from perfect. And there's a lot of work to do within the systems in this country. And you would think with being one of the richest countries, you would have way better systems that would suit the needs of the communities in which are within those systems. Really quickly, I want to give a history lesson very quick on the origination of Domestic Violence Awareness Month, which is observed every October to educate the public about domestic violence, honor and support survivors, and promote healthy, respectful relationships. The observance began as a day of unity in 1981 and evolved into a month-long effort by 1987, with Congress officially designating October as National Domestic Violence Awareness Month in 1989. During Domestic Violence Awareness Month, people are encouraged to wear purple to symbolize peace, courage, and solidarity with survivors. Some of those key aspects of Domestic Violence Awareness Month is awareness and education. October provides an opportunity to learn about the prevalence and impacts of domestic violence and the many forms it can take. And we also focus on survivor-centered support. Domestic Violence Awareness Month aims to uplift the voices, needs, and experiences of survivors, offering them a collective sense of support and solidarity, as well as community engagement. It serves as a time for organizations, advocates, and individuals to come together and connect with others who are motivated to end relationship violence. There's so many different ways for people to participate in Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Purple Thursday, spread the word on social media using hashtags like hashtag DBAM and hashtag with survivors to raise awareness. And also look at the organizations in your own communities to get involved with, volunteer for a crisis line. Obviously those are a lot of different ways, but also follow organizations and movements like the Rise Above Justice movement, shameless plug there, but also follow those people that are on the ground that are doing the work, like Brooke and countless others who are a part of this movement. And it's a very complex movement that has a lot of different moving parts. Because if we think about it, the intersectionality of domestic violence, gun violence, sexual assault, trafficking, sextortion, all of that plays a key role in trauma. Thinking about intersectionality, Brooke, what other aspects of your work does it cross into? Because trauma is very complex.
Oh yeah. I think a lot of people think of trauma as just like a singular event, like a car crash or, a bigger event like military combat. But I think we all endure trauma to different levels. And I think we, to some extent, some more than others, but I think the deepest wound from trauma we can get is through interpersonal relationship traumas. Like we hear the terms like childhood trauma or complex PTSD, and those stem from, having people harm you essentially. And a lot of people, the work I do when we go into trauma therapy, a lot of people feel a lot of shame and feel obviously hurt from different areas in their life, but come to this realization that oftentimes the hardest part to heal from these traumas is, having a person, and oftentimes it's a loved one, intentionally cause us harm, or they're causing us harm and they're not, being the healthy adult and going to therapy and doing that deeper inner work to not cause these wounds. So I see it everywhere. And I think the systems that we're in model the very oppressive behaviors we're seeing from the government down right now. I think might sound a little bit like tinfoil hat here, but I think a lot of our systems praise and say that they're going to help us and keep us healthy and safe, just like the justice system and the medical and mental health system. But I think they really profit on, unfortunately, violence, violence committed mostly by men, with all the, violence you just listed. The common denominator we're seeing is, unfortunately, men, white men. And and just for example, with like the mental health system, I work a lot with eating disorder clients so that they work through, their own, usually stemming from some sort of relational childhood trauma history. It manifests with their relationship to food. And, in the systems we're under, we have diet culture everywhere. Like, how can a person escape and heal from their, eating disorder when everything is thrown in our face about weight loss? How can they really heal their relationship to food when they're at home and maybe a sibling or parent is an abuser and they're trying to eat a meal with them? So I think things don't happen in a singular like vacuum, like we're kind of told or believe. I think it all stems down to the root of it is some form of relational trauma, and the systems are built to keep enabling it because they profit off of it.
Yes, absolutely. I agree entirely with that statement that our systems profit off of trauma and violence. You're absolutely right. And, as a survivor myself, I oftentimes receive messages from other survivors and they're like, how do I navigate this system? And oftentimes I leave it there for a good like hour or two because I'm like, you know, something that worked for me may not work for them. Something that worked for them may not work for me, you know, and because these are just very complex and these systems are designed to do more harm than they are to do good. And that's the reality. But then there's people like you that are challenging those systems and helping others challenge it as well. You know, oftentimes people will sit and they will watch TV shows like the Special Victims Unit. Do not get me wrong, Olivia Benson is one of the most incredible human beings. But honestly, I wish that there were more people in these actual police departments across the communities that were like Olivia Benson or Elliot Stabler or John Munch, right, from the earlier seasons of Special Victims Unit, because you know the new season just started, and it makes it look like to where you can walk into a police department and say, I was raped, and they take you into this room and they just interview you and they believe you, and then you have your day in court and your perpetrator goes to prison. It's glorified. And it makes it look very easy. But then whenever somebody goes through it and like an actual real life, you know, as a legit person going through this trauma, they realize how much more complex it is and how much more difficult it is to overcome those barriers and the obstacles to understand what the system actually looks like. Whenever you watch, have you ever watched Special Victims Unit at all? Or have you ever watched like any of those TV shows like that?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
What has been your reaction? You know, because obviously you have worked with people who are going through that trauma. What have you seen? So what you see on TV is obviously not what you see in your clients or in the community or in your own experiences. But how do we as a society recognize that, and how and why is it important to recognize that that always is the case?
Spot on with what you said. I think they glorify it, or I don't even think they realize they're glorifying how easy the process is, because I think a lot of people that haven't been in this situation, it should be, you know, what's right and what's fair and what's legal. The perpetrator should always go to jail, right? Because that's what's comfortable for people, emotionally, psychologically, because ignorance is bliss in a way, because a lot of people don't believe it could happen to them. But I guess I'll add nuance here where I won't talk as much about the legal system, because I think we hear a lot about that, fortunately, and unfortunately, you know, we see cases of like Gabby Petito, you know, these horrible cases that they can point out, like where the legal system went wrong and challenging our views on, you know, relationships in that way. I will kind of add some nuance of maybe the justice system in court, but also mental health, kind of the intersection of those two, because I was there as a therapist, believing, you know, us as therapists, we're all doing what's best and helpful for people, which is true. I believe like most of us go into these fields wanting to make a difference. So this is not to shame anyone specifically in any system, but I think we don't realize the level of misogyny and stigma, especially around like mental health and of course racism, that comes into play. So in my lived experience, I was terrified to escape my abuser because he held my own like mental health over me. You know, I realized like I am mentally sound, I'm mentally stable. But when you're in an abusive situation, of course you're going to have, you know, trauma-like symptoms come up. You're going to be human, and you know, even if I just had a normal human emotion and reaction to something, even like positive emotions like laughter, he would weaponize against me and call me, you know, hysterical, emotional, crazy, dramatic, all of those misogynistic terms in over time really like degraded my sense of self. And at one point, here's the trigger warning for a lot of people. It was a variety of factors in my relationship in 2020, leading off with my family cutting me off completely from them due to their very, very conservative. I posted something about Black Lives Matter, supporting that movement in June of 2020, May or June, and they immediately cut me off. And just with my own history of childhood trauma, that was absolutely devastating. One of my worst fears to happen, and couldn't wrap my mind around it. And my abuser definitely weaponized that to his benefit to keep me isolated, but to really just like degrade me and tear me down. So I attempted suicide in September of 2020. And fortunately, he saved me, but did not help me get medical treatment. He unfortunately then continued to hang that over my head for the rest of our marriage, that I was mentally ill and unstable. And if he went to therapy because I traumatized him so much over it, he would make sure that I would lose my license in New York State. He would make sure that people would think I was mentally insane. And it was a true fear of mine, because being a therapist in this field, like, I understand if a person comes into therapy and gives that story, he could frame it however he wanted, and was worried what a therapist could do or think. And clearly he had malicious intent. So that was a big reason why I didn't leave, because I was fearful of that story getting out public, because that was a part of me that I really shamed and really kept hidden. Up until probably a year before I escaped, I finally told a therapist of mine, and that was fortunately like a huge breakthrough moment, to really lessen the dark parts and that shame, and have just someone, like, I know my therapist got up and like hugged me for a half hour on the couch, and that was so pivotal in my healing. But there was that, just like that stigma and fear. And when I did leave and escape, I went and petitioned for an order of protection, and I know that the DV advocate worker that helped me file my petition did tell me that something like that, a suicide attempt, could be definitely used against me in the court system, and I could potentially lose custody of my daughter. Because, even though we like to say that in 2025 that we're all mental health aware and, destigmatizing it, rah, 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 I think it's in ways still bullshit, because the court system, has taken away women's mothers' custody, even if they have postpartum depression on their chart somewhere, a normal response that we see. And I made the choice to be open about that suicide attempt on my petition still, despite that, because they said that that was pretty profound evidence of one of the worst cases of domestic violence that they've seen here. I'm in Monroe County, which is Rochester, a big major city. And so to have a domestic violence worker that was working, I think, at least for 5 years there in the unit say her jaw was on the floor when I gave some of my details of my story, I just went forward with it and felt so raw and vulnerable, having multiple judges review my case. And that's terrifying for women to have to hash out all of their trauma just to be believed, is really, really unfortunate. But you're at the mercy of what the judge looks at and sees. And fortunately, in the legal system, in my experience, like you said, it just depends on the humans you come across, and fortunately, and how they interpret it. I had two judges, both like have sympathy for me. And my attorney, later on, I got an attorney after I filed for the order of protection and got it, did warn me as well that, the judge that I might have, we probably were going to have, could be, unfortunately, have the same stigmas and judge you for this and tear you apart on the stand. And, it's, you're meeting your second abuser in the court system. But I was prepared, because I think at least that set me free. At least naming it and saying I attempted, because there's so much shame and stigma around it, led me to reclaim my power around that story, instead of letting my abuser just terrorize me for it and tear me down as a human. But I know for a lot of women, they get, a different response than both judges that, gave me sympathy, and that judge, my second judge in our divorce, that had more power over custody, like, looked me dead in the eye. I remember that day I was shaking and sweating, and I was on, unfortunately, like Google Teams, having to meet for court is surreal, but just looked at me, and I was in my therapy office and said, I don't because my abuser was claiming I was bipolar, schizophrenic at one point, just incredibly mentally ill, but also said that he claimed I never attempted suicide. So my abuser just completely committed perjury the entire trial. That's a whole other topic where you can commit perjury and have no repercussions as a man, but to have a judge look at me and say, like, I'm proud of you and I see that you're doing so much better for yourself. I don't believe your ex was like the most healing moment of my life that more of 10 years of therapy could have done. So I'm just so thankful by whatever act of the God or universe that I could get some empathy and sympathy in that moment, because I can't imagine the terror of other people having to face the court system and not being believed and or dehumanized over that. Something so vulnerable to yourself that you have to keep hidden for years. So, and again, just to wrap that all up, like I think we want to believe that every system is here to help and protect us, but if you have just something as simple as anxiety slapped in your chart, the court could deem you as mentally ill and unwell and unfit as a parent.
Brooke, thank you so much for sharing your story, in a very candid way and unfiltered way too, because, part of this podcast is to give a platform to those stories who oftentimes go unheard, unseen, and not told by the mainstream media, because the mainstream media is complicit in silence. And I've come to realize that, and I think the older that I get, the more I realize it. And the more that I understand what is going on across the country, and even more so now, my mom being diagnosed with stage three cervical cancer, it kind of opened my eyes a lot more. And it ignited a new fight in me that I didn't even know that I had. And whenever I see how the systems try to silence her by taking away her Medicaid and taking away other assistance that she was receiving, and seeing what's happening now. And it's still a very real reality that one day we could wake up and her Medicaid could be completely gone. And then the question pops in, well, what if she has to go to the emergency room because she's reaction to one of her medications? Or what if she needs more radiation or more chemotherapy in order to survive? Who in the hell has the money to pay for that? Because these medical systems are so damn predatory. And God forbid we have any assistance. So I think about that. And it's the very real reality that we have in the country. Again, one of the richest countries and some of the poorest communities and some of the poorest systems in the entire world. Whenever I created the Rise Above Justice movement, did I ever imagine what it would become? No. But it's connecting me to people like you, Brooke, that inspire me on a daily basis with your content. And you're just very well put together, and you present your story in a way that a lot of people are not able to. And I know it hasn't always been like that. When did you begin like content creation, and what inspired you to begin sharing your story online?
Well, firstly, I just want to send my heart out to you and your mom and just the whole Medicaid debacle. I see that with clients so many times and other health insurances. But I guess with content creation, I have always had a platform and advocated for mental health in some form or manner, especially since I opened my own private practice in August of 2022. It was 4 months postpartum, and actually 2 weeks after I jumped ship from working at a mental health practice that was a little bit more, stable and some time off and stuff like that, I just realized I could not do the 40-hour work week that the US demands, especially on a new mom that was trying to breastfeed. And I just took that leap of faith, and with it, I created my own platform for myself and my private practice to talk more specifically about mental health and kind of attract some clients there and market. So I've always kind of had a presence and did wean back on it for the from probably 2023 to 2024, just being under the domestic violence. I would had no joy, but initially it was a great creative outlet, at least for me. And it was low stakes because I had a full caseload of clients. So I just wanted to put my messages out there. But, as I started to open up more about my like what I went through with abuse, last fall, actually last September, I released my first blog article and honestly wanted to throw up and shit my pants when I put my story out there of what I was gone through and how, my first blog article was about how I got my order of protection. Because we were wrapping up our divorce, but was worried, could he bring this in and his attorney tear it apart? And just that constant fear, but something in me, propelled me to release it since I think it was the movie that was released last year. I think it's called It Ends With Us with Blake Lively. And I didn't ever watch it, but got the reviews that like it was domestic violence, but they glamorized it. So I just wrote an article about how domestic violence can impact all of us, critiquing the overall premise of that movie. And I just got such a profound response from it was mostly to my personal circle. But a lot of like friends really were just like, oh my gosh, like you need to keep sharing your story. And people would joke, like, you need to make a full TikTok and all of this about your story. And I was really worried about doing it actually, because there's a lot of ethics in the mental health world, to not, personally disclose too much. There's a lot of gray area about therapists being content creators. There's a lot of critiques, especially with therapists that might come from older generations. But I still, beside that, I was like, you know what? I'm going to do it, because there's a lot of therapists online that, even write autobiographies and have their platforms about their lived experience. They might be much more famous than me, so they're getting maybe less pushback. But it's like, I'm just going to go for it because so many content creators in 2024 inspired me and empowered me and showed me like I wasn't alone and I wasn't this, I was just shaming myself so much. Like, how could I miss this? I'm a couples therapist, damn it. Like, how could I be in this mess and felt like I had to hide it? And the more I voiced my story online, the more people just encouraged it. And I've honestly been able to connect with a few, actually lots of well-known content creators that have guided me and assisted me in my journey. So that's been really inspiring as well and empowering. And through it, I've really had to be kind of goofy, funny, authentic. And it's actually been a really big healing tool for myself. Maybe it's not for everyone, but I just know that when we're able to tap into that creative flow of combining my storytelling with content creation to connect with people, I think that's kind of my jam. And that's a huge pivotal sign of like healing for people is when our nervous system can feel safe enough to be our authentic self and, kind of channel that pain into somewhere else that can be such a gift. So, kind of really officially started more of the content creation, honestly, in the last like 6 months or so. And now that's just kind of a big, it's not, has to be a platform to attract clients now, for my business and to get my message out to help others.
Absolutely, and I absolutely love the way that you present your content and the way that you do it, because like you said, you bring a little bit of the humor to it, but you also bring that human side to these stories, right? And there was a headline yesterday about, we're talking about systems, we're talking about how survivors are not believed, and there was a headline that broke yesterday about Robert Morris, who was a Texas megachurch pastor. He finally has pled guilty to sexually abusing a child. And under the plea agreement, Morris was given a 10-year sentence, but he will only serve 6 months in an Oklahoma jail. Robert Morris, the Texas megachurch pastor who built Gateway Church into one of the largest congregations in the country, pleaded guilty Thursday, so October 2nd, in Osage County District Court to charges that he sexually abused a girl in the 1980s. He is 64 years old now. He entered the plea before Judge Cindy Pickerell, admitting to 5 felony counts of lewd or indecent acts with a child. Under a negotiated plea agreement, he was given a 10-year sentence, but he will only serve 6 months in the county jail. He must also register as a sex offender and pay $250,000 in restitution. Morris was handcuffed and taken into custody after the hearing. Unfortunately, cases like this are not, it's so, I'm losing the words that I want to use to describe this, but my heart goes out to Cindy Klimashire, who is that survivor. And she was 12 years old when the abuse happened, and her abuser is finally headed to jail, even though he's only serving 6 months. Hearing that story, what's your reaction?
I guess I hate to say it. I'm sitting here just shaking my head, but I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised because this is why survivors don't report. If, like, unfortunately in our system, I think what most of the time they don't even get like sentence or like we see this, right? A very drastic reduction. So I don't know. I'm just appalled. I hate the saying that like false accusations ruin men's lives. And I know abusers don't have to be just men, but it's predominantly men. It like actual like true allegations and findings like this barely ruins this guy's life. He's that's minimal compared to what he should have gotten. So yeah, it's just devastating. And again, I think this is why a lot of people don't have the courage to report, or like the amount of like trauma and stress that puts the survivor under to have to maybe testify and prepare, all of this evidence.
Exactly. And whenever we hear about funding cuts happening at the national level, 19th News reported about it took more years of advocacy to pass the Violence Against Women Act for the first time in 1994, a landmark legislation that built a web of federal policies and funding to address domestic and intimate partner violence, a pervasive health and safety crisis. In 8 months, that safety net is in jeopardy. Funding pauses, cuts, firings, and information purges have destabilized the infrastructure that helps victims of abuse. At the same time, federal teams dedicated to preventing sexual violence are being decimated. Departments in charge of administering grants that fund shelters for those fleeing assault have been deemed duplicative, DEI, or simply unnecessary. And I'm going to do a deeper dive into this in just a second, but there's. Survivors, unfortunately, our very existence is political, but it goes beyond that. And it goes to just being a decent human being and start by believing somebody who went through a traumatic experience or telling their truth or telling their story. And 57.4 million is the amount Department of Justice grants earmarked for domestic abuse and sexual assault that were revoked in April, according to a grassroots data effort. New funding restrictions are impacting domestic violence services. In 2022, the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act created a funding scheme for culturally specific service providers, which are tailored to the needs of Asian, Black, Native American, Hawaiian, or Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander or Latinx survivors. A new rule required organizations applying for funding to comply with executive orders from January banning elite, quote unquote, illegal DEI and quote unquote woke gender ideology. Litigation is currently ongoing with this. And the guidance remains very broad. And it doesn't give, like, they sent out an email and they're like, oh, we need you to eliminate this. But they didn't tell them what to specifically eliminate, what to add into that spot or anything. It was just, oh, this is woke. We need it to be removed or you're not receiving your funding. And groups also had to agree not to use federal grant money for specific unallowed activities. And it gave some very broad definitions of everything. And I also want to point out a couple statistics that were also in this article from 19th News. 61 million is the number of women nationwide who have experienced abuse at the hands of a romantic partner. Of those, 16 million first experienced intimate partner violence before they turned 18 years old. These are statistics that are not surprising, but I also feel that the numbers are also incredibly more higher and are watered down due to the underreporting or survivors not reporting because the systems do not believe them. And you being doing the work that you do, hearing about the Medicaid cuts, hearing about, violence for these crucial, or oh gosh, funds being cut for these crucial services. How do we recognize the ongoing need for these services from your perspective? Because you have a unique perspective being this trauma doula, therapist, survivor, advocate. All those are intersecting identities that gives you a perspective that a lot of people don't have. What's your thoughts?
Oof, lots of thoughts here. So I'll just start with my vision, pie in the sky. If someone could grant me I don't know, my fairy godmother could give me just even $100,000, a million, I don't know. I want to create if we, I don't know, have kind of grassroots movement, but a sanctuary of just a community with homes where, safe people, women are there, like a lot of just like moms, where survivors can come, their kids can come, pets can come, and there's just like a safe, clean bed, and they could rest, and I could bring them warm food, watch their kids, brush their hair if they need like a week to recoup and just be at peace. And I think like a big piece of this, I would love to be able to give victims and survivors cash in hand, because the biggest resource a victim needs, actually, out of even I think the stats show, even over shelter, like going to a domestic violence shelter, like those are pivotal, right? Like that physical safety. But even with funding, domestic violence shelters don't provide long-term security, because one, the funding, they can't. And I think obviously domestic violence shelters aren't going to get funding and have been underfunded. Because again, I think the system honestly wants people to be oppressed. They don't, there's not any empathy or understanding. And I think it's intentional, especially in the society we're under. Patriarchal culture is women need to submit and be oppressed. So naturally there's, there's funding. And I even talked to a local domestic violence shelter director here in Rochester. It's called Willow, and the director and I had a really refreshing conversation, because she could admit we're part of the system. And yeah, our group therapies, yoga therapy, sure, those things are great, but survivors don't want to just be sitting there doing yoga on a Wednesday night. They need actual help, and we can't give them that. We don't get funding to give people money to just escape long term, right? Money to secure an attorney, money to secure an apartment, a deposit, down payment, new tires on their car if, they have a flat tire and they can't afford to replace it and get to work. Money, cash in hand. I think the stats show it's a little less than $1,000 on average is what a person needs to escape, just to be able to rebuild their life. Because I left my abuser with, honestly, negative $200 in my bank account that day, and driving to the courthouse, hyperventilating, how am I going to do it? And I'm fortunate enough that I own my own business at that time, and there was a ton of financial abuse, but I guess it worked more in my favor is that we never really combined much finances, because my ex was incredibly secretive about the, I'll just call it, shenanigans he was getting into, that he wanted to hide from me. So while he wasn't in control of my finances, all of my finances went to taking care of the house, daycare, furniture, groceries, you name it. I was the sole provider financially, so I couldn't save up any money. And it was in debt, actually, in some credit card debt, and he didn't contribute. So I think a big piece of it is that financial access and care, right? And then we think of the medical system. If Medicaid's getting cut, you can't get access to treatment, or you're going to be in thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt for medical care. The system, again, it just surrounds it all on money and wants to keep us oppressed in that way. So I think a lot of it, while it's very obviously depressing to hear and scary, I think we need more grassroots nonprofits, people to stand up, and we still have ways to find community and collective care, and it might not be a national widespread thing we can do, but we need to, I think, in times like this, find pockets of safe community and think outside the box.
Absolutely. And oftentimes that box doesn't have open ended or have like open ends, right? Because society wants all of us to be in a box and we have to mold into that box. And if you speak outside of that, you're seen as less than or you're not as important as your neighbor. And I guess my last question to you, Brooke, and we'll wrap up. But my last question to you is, if there was a survivor that came forward, and I know that this has happened, I imagine your messages from your content creation and your comments, because I've seen some of the comments too on your social media, thanking you for the work that you're doing. But if there's a survivor to message you right now asking, how can I get involved in making a difference? What would you tell them and why? Because this can look different for a lot of different people. Some people live in rural areas that don't have access to these organizations, but there's a lot of other things that they can also do. What would you recommend to them to get involved?
Yeah, and I think the most simple and cheapest way, because I'm here still trying to get through my own, mess of financial abuse. Like if I had all the money in the world, right, we can donate, we can help all this stuff. I think it's just believing another person. And I know like survivors are like more apt to, right, like believe and support and empathize with others, but I think just like not joining in, maybe like sometimes there's like a lot of like jokes about violence, domestic violence, or we are taught to remain silent and complicit in different ways out of fear, because of the backlash of what will my family say, what will my husband say or friends if I, stand up for this person or support them. I think just being open-minded and challenging your own internalized beliefs, because unfortunately, in this journey, I've learned that some of the biggest, I guess, I don't know how to put it. I wouldn't say they're not perpetrators or truly enablers, but I think the biggest challenge we all face as survivors has been other women, like straight heterosexual women, because I think they're under the guise or denial that, again, that this could even happen or happen to them. They're sold under, especially maybe religious principles that, being in a heterosexual relationship or marriage and submitting to your husband and believing, he's a great guy. There's good guys out there, but I believe a lot of these principles infiltrate even maybe not exactly abusive households, but I think if we even find other people or women making rude comments or challenging a survivor's story, that's so damaging. And I think even though it might seem really, really small, even on social media and trying to discredit other like survivors, like that's so damaging. I think other survivors, victims see it and, it just really stings deep. And it's like, I'm gonna remain silent because I'm gonna get judged if I talk about my story. And I guess that's why I'm so open and honest about it on social media. Again, that's not for everyone. You don't have to go and, divulge your entire diary, but I feel like I'm part of my healing is being strong enough and open enough to be like, hey, if this fucked up crap can happen to me here as a therapist, like I hope it can at least release others a little bit to begin to even just accept their own survival story, themselves. So I just think watching, like truly being careful of like, what am I saying? What am I doing that could be harmful to others? Because I want to maybe have to, have my friends be comfortable with me or the views of my family, just challenging those moments that you're like, no, that doesn't align with me, and just supporting maybe others that you might know are going through it, and just I think being there. So I think domestic violence doesn't have to be this big show of support. It's great. I want people to do that too. But if, people are uncomfortable with this, just starting with believing survivors and challenging your own internal biases.
Absolutely. And I too have my own internal bias. And I'm working on overcoming that myself. And it's definitely been a journey. And, you know, with like heavy colonization in these spaces is obviously something to debunk and to, you know, overcome as society. I do have a little bit of hope because there's people like you that are doing the work. And, you know, thank you for coming onto the podcast today. You know, you have an open invite anytime you have anything you would like to talk about or any updates in your work, or we can obviously do deeper dives into a lot of the subjects that were discussed today. And is there anything else that you would like to share with our listeners today?
No, one, I guess the last thing I'll leave is like, thank you so much. Like during this was really healing. You just like complimenting my content because two things, you know, my entire life I've been told I'm like either too much or too goofy or awkward. And especially from my abuser, was always told like I sounded stupid, silly, like always, I'm always so everything I do, I'm so second guessing. And just in general, self-esteem, it takes a lot of courage to be vulnerable and authentic. And I think to just be a content creator and put yourself out there. So you're really complimentary. And again, it was healing. And I'll just leave it with maybe like I guess I'll leave it with I think domestic violence again doesn't happen in a vacuum. And I think for a lot of people, normalizing, like sometimes this happens from where we're growing up. And I think when I first began posting, honestly, my dad called me, and this is definitely internalized misogyny on his end and/or abusive tactics from my family because they don't want me to speak out whatsoever about what happened for a variety of reasons. But he called me and literally told me, he's like, I'm gonna come and take you to the psychiatric hospital. Like, you probably should be an inpatient. Are you crazy? Essentially, for like posting online like that. Oh my God, what an embarrassment is really what it was. And that was really like humiliating to be like, oh my God, like my own family. I'm not surprised. I've done a ton of my work, right? Like my family is their own toxic mess, and how I got into an abusive situation is because they enact the same exact standards as my abuser did. So I was a bit blind to it, but I guess I just leaving it with like, thank you for seeing me and appreciating the content. So it is relieving and refreshing to get that feedback because I do get the feedback from survivors being like it's helpful, but I do get met with a lot of internalized misogyny and second guess myself where it's like she must be crazy, she's mentally unwell, what is she doing? But compliments like that keep me going.
Absolutely, you know, we're in this fight together, and one thing to always recognize is for every negative comment and every negative reaction, there's always somebody else that is watching that is going to be supportive. And you are making a difference, and you just continue being your authentic self because I think it brings a lot of people together, and oftentimes survivors are looking at social media for a glimpse of hope. These headlines are very heavy. These headlines are very deep, dark, and very, well, to put it lightly, very depressing. And we live in a very dark time where human rights are being invalidated, survivors are being silenced, and people like my mom continue to fight back against these systems because she needs it to survive. And oftentimes we hear, well, why didn't you just leave? Or what were you wearing whenever it comes to survivors? And I've heard those questions numerous times, even from the police department that I attempted to report to, like, well, you're a man. Why didn't you try to fight him off? Or were you not strong enough? Or are you that weak? And it's like, who exactly are you serving and protecting? Because it sure as hell is not me. I mean, and to be asked that question, and to be asked any of those questions is very detrimental to survivors' mental health or physical health or emotional well-being, and oftentimes leads to attempting suicide is by not being believed. So, Brooke, thank you for being on the podcast today. I greatly appreciate you beyond belief. You already know that, though. And to anybody out there who is listening, be sure to follow Brooke on social media. Brooke, what's your handles across social media?
Oh, thank you so much. I have two. I post from a professional one, more professional one, Reclaim with Brooke, on Instagram. And that's maybe more of like the psychoeducation content. I do share some of my personal story there. And then I also have my personal one, Brooke Lalone on my Instagram as well. I opened that up to the public a little while ago where I post some more goofy content because I just like to be a little bit more lighthearted there too in the reality of all because it is so devastating. So want us to find our I still want us to have fun and laugh. I think that's medicine. So there I am
Yes.
at Instagram. And also you can find me on Facebook, Reclaim with Brooke, and TikTok, brooke.lalone.
All right, my friend. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. You have a good day, okay?
Thank you so much. You as well.
Thank you.